Big Adventures with Brian Durker is brought to you by SWCA. Since our founding in Flagstaff in 1981, SWCA Environmental Consultants has helped public and private clients overcome environmental challenges and move their projects forward. As we celebrate our 40th year in business, our 100% employee-owned firm offers comprehensive environmental planning, regulatory compliance, and natural and cultural resources management services. We are the problem solvers, the scientists, the planners, the technical specialists, and the creative thinkers. Thank you, SWCA, for your support of Big Adventures. Our friend Lynn is also supporting us this week. Thank you, Lynn, and we hope to see you on the river.
You guys, welcome, welcome, welcome. Another episode of Big Adventures with Brian Durker and Mark Lamberson today. Mark, you and I go back far. It's started out around skiing. I remember the first day you came into my little garage.
Yeah, Dick McCallum's.
Over at Dick McCallum's and introduced yourself. You were new to town. And you had just gotten that place from Pinkerman.
Yeah, the Flagstaff Sportsman was from Russ Pinkerman and Bill Higley.
Bill Higley. And it was in one of those buildings where the city center down there is.
It's now where the solar panels are in the city
garage, that's right.
The city open parking lot, and Lou Bader's sculpture out there. And it was a big old building. It was an old Chrysler dealership.
Right. And it was really kind of a big spread out building.
Cavernous. And that was, as we made this business deal to get Flagstaff Sportsman, part of it was that we were picking up a little piece of history that in the back of this cavernous room was a ski deck, an indoor ski ramp that they had built for Sis Pinkerman to give lessons on.
Yep.
At the snowboard.
Exactly. I knew that store well. And I remember that. But before we get into the weeds of such things, let's talk about your early life. You were born where?
New Jersey.
New Jersey.
Yep.
And then kind of just give us a progression of your early years, Mark.
Born in the countryside of New Jersey. My dad would commute into New York City every day on the train. And I just pretty rural, and I am the oldest of six kids, and I was the one who had to go out and get the eggs out of the chicken coop, and the rooster would always attack me and make my life miserable. But
so is this upstate?
Northern New Jersey, kind of right on the edge of New York and New Jersey, a place called Mahwah, which, again, is on the train. It's a train station to New York City, and that's what everyone did back then.
What was your father's profession?
He was with Look magazine. That's an old magazine,
wow.
Like Life magazine.
Yeah, I remember Look magazine. Yeah.
He was in their advertising, so he sold the ads to all the big national companies. And from New Jersey and New York, his promotion took him to Detroit, and that's where we went again with Look magazine, and finally to Cleveland, Ohio, with Look magazine. So we were moving around. He was doing the corporate thing, and he and my mom were having six kids, and I had lots of buddies to play with all the time, and so New Jersey was kind of five, six years old, so I don't remember a lot about that, but the real fun time was once we moved to Michigan. That was the Bloomfield Hills, which is a rural suburb area of Detroit, and we lived on a lake, which was so cool.
Oh, and what moved you down there? Your dad
yep.
picked up?
The next step would Look magazine, and being a kid there was... I remember the being on this little lake called Pine Lake. The day school would get out, I put my bathing suit on, and I would not take that bathing suit off until school started in September. I'd sleep in it, eat in it. Everything was on the lake.
That sounds great. Did you have a little boat?
Oh, a couple of boats, row boats, and then you get a little older, and we had a ski boat, so we'd have to wait for my dad to get home from work and go water skiing, and then you get old enough that you can have a rowboat with a 10-horse motor on. It's like freedom. I mean, because everything would happen on the lake. So you take the 10-horse motor boat across the lake to the little marina and buy a popsicle and think you're a big kid.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then there'd probably be like Spanky and the gang that lived on the lake. So all the other kids and stuff. That sounds great.
Yeah, you'd put together your different tribes of fun kids and do things. And then in the winter, it was all pond hockey because that lake would freeze over nice and hard. So we'd just be out there all the time in skates and pushing snow out of the way to set up a hockey rink. And I played a lot of hockey up till about 10, 11 years old, and that's when I got into skiing. But it wasn't until then, and I didn't know anything about skiing. And
so you still lived in Michigan clear through your early school years? Or
through grade school. And then once got out of grade school, that's when the family moved to Cleveland.
Ooh.
Suburban area called Shaker Heights. And
that's where I was. Was that good, or was it a little bit of a buzzkill?
You know, you're an adolescent, and you don't know what's going on anyway. You're just being a jerk to everyone. And, you know. So, yeah, Cleveland fit right in for me being a jerk. And I did a lot of sports in school, but it was urban. In fact, from Cleveland, we're jumping ahead a little bit, but yeah, we lived on a place called Van Aken Boulevard, which was this huge grass boulevard between the two streets. And down the middle of the grass boulevard was called the Rapid Transit. And my dad would get on that every day and commute to downtown Cleveland. And same thing, not having a driver's license, we would use the Rapid Transit to go to the drugstore, go to the public pool. And so it was urban living. But Michigan is where I started skiing.
What was the mountain?
Yeah, there were two mountains. Actually, the first place I learned how to ski was in the basement of a conference room at a place called Don Thomas Sport House. That was the ski shop outdoor store in Detroit. I learned how to ski by lecture. It was like four Wednesday nights in a row. We'd go to these 2-hour lectures in the basement of Don Thomas Sport House. And it's a little conference room. And the guy teaching the lecture was Stein Erickson.
In Detroit.
And he was...
And for the listeners, Stein Erickson is like incredibly historically famous skier.
He was one of the famous Europeans that came over to North America.
And he was an Olympiad.
Yep. It was Oslo, Norway, the Winter Olympics, maybe in the 50s. And he got a gold medal there. And he was Norwegian and use that to make his claim in North America. And
he made his claim.
Yeah, he did. And I think many, many people have Stein Erickson stories because he wasn't loyal to any one place. He'd go wherever and would pay him. And back then, Michigan was paying him, and that's where he kind of started. And he was running some ski schools near there. And that's where we graduated to after our indoor ski lessons.
So you actually did get up on the hill with Stein.
Yep. But this indoor lecture is wild because he'd have an assistant holding a piece of plywood with carpet on, and that was the hill. So you hold the carpet at an angle, and Stein would stand on the 4x8 sheet of plywood showing what
edges were
and what a wedge was. And
that is one of the greatest ski stories I have ever heard. I was never aware of this. Stein Erickson, Detroit.
I don't think he'd admit it. He might not admit it. And, of course, he's deceased now. But
he was real on the ground floor of Deer Valley outside of Park City there in Utah. And then he had the Stein Erickson Lodge.
Yep.
And he had a...
Oh, he had...
Remember, he had the world's most expensive ski when they came out with him. I think it was called Pure Gold.
That's right. That's right.
That was his signature ski. I mean, he was the deal.
He knew how to market himself, and he was the original glue booter. Remember that style of his? His legs were always, his boots were always just strapped together tight and big eagle wing swooping down the hill. And
kind of.
Very unique look.
Yeah, and very elegant, old school sort of Christian Pravda-y sort of thing.
Yeah.
But before we slide too deep into the skiing stuff, other than sitting in a basement room with Stein Erickson in Detroit, that is a good one. And was it kind of just a, how big was your high school? Tell us a little about those formative years in high school, Mark.
The high school and junior high, it was a, you know, Shaker Heights, all those communities are right next to each other. So you got 30,000 population, Shaker Heights right next to Cleveland Heights, right next to Euclid. And so our high school was just one high school. And I don't know if I can remember the size, but it was a big place. And there was plenty of sports and activities and quite a culturally diverse community because it was historically known as a big community for Jewish families. And then also a lot of folks who were of color were mixed there too. So I'm not Jewish, and obviously I'm not color. And so it was really a cool experience with just lots of black kids and lots of Jews. And in fact, a lot of people thought I was a Jew, and I never was. I'm a recovering Catholic, as I say. but it was kind of neat. There's the ethnic and racial diversity and lots of fun. I mean, even though I said earlier that I was just kind of being a jerk, I think I was just being a jerk because I was the oldest of six kids in my family. But
right. No, that's...
But good buddies that we'd do more skiing. And from there, there was little local ski areas you'd go to for Brandywine and Alpine Valley. And a guy named Mark Gulo in town came out of
Mark Alpine. Works for me, yeah.
Yeah, he's an old Alpine Valley guy.
Yeah.
And a lot of night skiing. It's all about night skiing there. So we'd have Wednesday night race league in the lights. And you'd always remember that they would be sure and watch out because the gate's coming down the hill. They'd always hide one of the gates in the shadow of the lights. You wouldn't be able to see it because the poor lighting coming down the hill.
Oh, yeah. That's great stuff. And then you went through, graduated from high school. And then what was your next step outside of the skiing, outside of the sport part of it?
A lot of it was because of skiing. My first job in Cleveland as a kid was in ski shops. I was 15 years old and my buddy was 16, had the driver's license. So he'd pick me up. We'd go work at a ski shop. So I just somehow really latched onto this sport and all aspects, just my personal enjoyment on the hill, but the business side of it too. So when it came to time to look for schools, graduating from Shaker Heights, I didn't want to go to Midwestern schools. And I wound up being accepted at the University of Colorado in Boulder.
That's what brought you out west.
Exactly. And I, for many different reasons, I never really looked back. I started in Boulder as a freshman. And during that time, my mom and dad and the other five younger siblings left Cleveland and moved to Cheyenne, Wyoming, which is a place I never lived. But so I didn't, I had a few friends in Cleveland and Shaker Heights, but I lost touch with them and all my real important years started in Boulder with going to school, or I should say trying to go to school. I was working in ski shops. I was teaching an instructor up at Lake Eldora Ski Area, the Big E, which is Rob Lim. We worked there.
Yeah, okay.
And, that's part of his pedigree. And ski race leagues, again.
Yeah.
So I was going to 2 years in Boulder, not doing well in school. I was skiing 4 days a week and going to school 3 days a week, so that really didn't work out. And
I can identify with such stories.
They decided to say, you're not coming back. About the same time I said, I'm done, I'm leaving here. And that's what started my next part of my career was moving to Aspen for a couple of years. So
that must have been kind of an exciting time in your life. I mean, you go from Boulder, and oh, by the way, you've probably seen tremendous change in that town from those years to, I was in Boulder last year and I didn't recognize the place at all.
Yes.
The changes it's gone through.
You're right.
Phenomenal.
Phenomenal. And heads up, that's what we're heading for here in Flagstaff.
Well, I've always said Flagstaff's 40 years behind Boulder, and I'm afraid it probably is, except we don't really have the water Boulder had, but that doesn't seem to be slowing them down, does it?
It's not slowing them,
and
it's not slowing us.
And for the listener, we're in a small town here, Flagstaff, Arizona, and it's really going through some of those awkward growth pains of a small town as far as infrastructure and interest in people moving in here. And
the economics of that is similar because we're a university town. Boulder's a university town, outdoor-oriented just like they are. And they did something which we haven't done here, but they did a green belt. Back 40 years ago, the citizens said, we're going to vote in and buy a green belt all the way around the city, which was very nice and outdoor and lovely. And Flagstaff's version of that is called the National Forest. We're surrounded by a green belt also. It's wonderful, but also it really, in my opinion, causes prices to go up because there's no place to go. You got to start doing infill, and you got to Boulder's much more expensive than we are, and we're already expensive. And you're right, we're looking at the Boulder model, and it's coming.
Yeah, and it's difficult for us, you know, fudgety old locals, to see that kind of growth. But it's the real world. All Western towns really are going through, or most of them. Maybe not so much Winslow, but even Williams is starting to go
finally
through it. Yeah,
all nice places to live seem to be growing right now,
A mad rat.
And I don't want to live anywhere else. I love it here.
Well, it's kind of the rebound. There was always the great westward movement of people. I mean, from the start of this country, it's always been westward movement. Well, they piled up on the West Coast, and now I think it's the backsplash from that westward movement that's bouncing back east.
Yeah, filling in the gaps.
Filling in all the gaps. Now, let's talk about Aspen. When you went to Aspen, were you working at a shop there?
Yep, I've always been working in ski shops. That's my thing. Then a place called Sporthaus Lindner, Fritz Lindner. He was an Austrian who came over first generation, and he was one of 20 ski shops in Aspen, and this is the early 70s. And I just worked hard. You'd get a lot of skiing in, but a lot of work, because we'd open at 8 o'clock in the morning and we'd be open until 10 o'clock at night, kind of like what you do, and just work real hard, and then get your days off to go skiing. And I lived down valley in a place called Basalt in the Lazy Glen Trailer Court, owned by Glenn Campbell. And
even the trailer courts have some celebrity behind them. They've all been there,
yeah. Fancy trailer court. But I'd hitchhike into town every day. I didn't even have a card. So it was right on the highway, and I'd hitchhike into town. And between being a young man and skiing hard and partying hard, I'd have a hard time getting to work and on time. So they finally fired me just because, Lamberson, you don't know how to get to work on time. You're fired. And you're right. I screwed up. I skied a little for another week or two, and then my money started running out. But I was such a good salesman and technician for them. My manager, Jim Pomeroy, finally said, hey, let's talk. And he says, you want a job? I said, oh, yeah, I need a job. And he said, well, come on back. And what we'll do is we'll set it up so you don't have to come to work at 8 o'clock in the morning anymore. We'll let you come in at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
I don't want the guys that work for me to even hear this interview.
Yeah, he designed a schedule around my lifestyle.
Yes. And if any of you are my employees at this point, it's not going to happen, guys.
Yeah.
It worked for Mark. It ain't going to work for you.
This is Naspen.
And so you worked for a couple years and leisured in when you could start and then worked till 10.
Yeah, you'd still work till 10 or even midnight to get all those bindings mounted.
Oh, yeah. And I can identify with that.
And part of that time was it was all foam boots back then. Every boot we sold was foam injected.
Yeah.
And that was good and bad because it was a good, precise fit, but it was too precise. And we'd have grown men crying in the foam boot stand that you have to wear the boots for 30 minutes.
Yeah, I was in that Lang Pro, the first injected boot.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And Tom LaBeouf at the Purple Ski down here, I thought he was the meanest bastard I'd ever met he just ignored my pain as they turned up the pressure and injecting these boots.
Yep, we had a full bar set up right at the boot fitting stand just to liquor people up to try and kill the pain.
Oh, wow, that's smart.
And as we all realize, is the women can handle the pain much better than the men. But most importantly, they drop everything off, they get their boots foamed, and then they go out and party all night and come in and get their gear the next morning that we'd been spending all night mounting and prepping. And you'd say, here you are, Mr. Durker, here's your new boots. And we couldn't get them on their feet. These custom fit boots were too custom fit. And because they were enjoying the partying of Aspen, their feet would, you know, your limbs swell up from alcohol. So between partying at night and too close a fit.
Oh, that's interesting.
The brand new boot we'd be trying to get on their foot the next morning, 8 hours later, we'd have to get out the grinder immediately and start tearing apart.
These
liners that we had spent all this time custom fitting.
So. Oh, that's we learn the hard way, don't we?
Yeah, that's the story of the ski
industry. And for the listener, you know, as long as Mark's been in this business, and I've been in a long time too, the progression of the equipment has been a fascinating story in its own right. And the ski boot, of course, is that connection between the skis and the snow to your person, an incredibly important element in the gear that you know a good skier will have a footbed, a customized liner, and some of these high-tech, really super well-designed shell shapes and different flexes, and so that in combination with a safe binding and the way they build skis, it's really made the sport a lot easier for people to learn.
And comfortable.
And comfortable. I mean, you can buckle up your boots these days and not touch the boot until you get out of them.
That took a long time.
At the end of the day. But it's been, for us, it's been a really cool part of our interest in the sport. I know it is for you, and it certainly is for me. Yeah. Okay, so you're in Aspen. Let's talk, how'd you end up in Casper?
From Aspen, after 2 years, we kind of looked around, Rosie and I, my wife, and I had a brother in Steamboat. He's doing the same sort of thing with his wife and young wife like we were. We were a young couple. And we had a family friend who said, I'll put up a little grub stake for you if you guys want to start a ski shop. So,
well, there's an offer.
Yeah, well, it was $25,000.
Yeah.
And we were able to match it with an SBA loan of $25,000. We thought, in 1973, that was millions of dollars. It was so.
Now, fast. This is you and Rosie, or was your brother involved?
Yeah.
Or?
Yep. Bruce, my brother, was the partner in the business, and Rosie was trying to be a young mother, mostly raising two kids, so she wasn't as active in the company. But as we were looking around, we had this grub stake, and we said, "Well, we could be the 22nd or 23rd ski shop in Aspen if we want to, but." Yikes, you know, that's pretty fierce competition.
Yeah, I'd say.
And somehow it was through, as I mentioned, the family had moved to Cheyenne, Wyoming, and my dad was no longer with Look Magazine. He had a small business consulting company called General Business Services that was tied in a national deal. But because of that, he was always covering the state of Wyoming, helping small businesses that were kind of in a niche. They weren't big enough to have a full-time CPA helping them out, but they really, this is back before QuickBooks, and they really were struggling how to just run their business.
They needed help, yeah.
So he had heard about Casper, Wyoming, which was right in the middle of the state. And Casper, as it was then and always has been, is a really unique little town, energy development town. It was one of the wealthiest zip codes back in the 50s and 60s. Hmm. Because of oil. And they, from there, as the oil would taper off, then coal came on. And as that would taper off, uranium and all these different energies coming and going is their legacy. And so they've always been through boom and bust cycles. And they had a local ski area. And there was a ski shop there that was struggling and going out of business. And so we checked it out. We did a business study there. And it looked promising for two young whelps who thought we knew everything about ski business, but didn't know anything at all. And,
didn't know better, right?
And got started in Casper, Wyoming. And the business, so we made a corporation. You know, We had to look up the rules and what that means to be a corporation. And in part of corporation, someone's got to be president, someone's got to be secretary, treasurer for legality reasons. And my brother Bruce and I were kind of going, oh man, who's going to be president of our company? We're equal partners and we were going to draw straws. And then the lawyer told us, well, it's already decided. He says, Mark, you're going to be president because you're the only one old enough. You're 21 years old and Bruce is 19 and you have to be 21 or older to be president of a corporation in Wyoming.
So you became president.
President of 21 years old of Mountain Sports Incorporated.
What sort of surrounding distances from Casper are your ski areas?
Well, there's the local mountain, Hogadon Basin, which is just even closer to downtown Casper than the Snow Bowl is to downtown Flagstaff. And then on weekends, our customers would go up to Jackson Hole or down to Steamboat Springs. And those are about 4 or 5 hour drive in either direction. So we'd run a lot of bus trips to those places for weekend getaways for our customers and just worked real hard and built it up pretty quickly.
Cool. And are there other ski shops there now?
My brother still has Mountain Sports.
Yeah.
And he does still ski and snowboard and Nordic and a big Trek bike dealer. And so he still has that all sports, all outdoor sports models, still works for him in Casper, Wyoming.
Has there been much growth in Casper? I'll bet it's another town that's probably run into that, right?
It is growing. It because of these energy cycles, it goes to these booms and busts. So when we moved to Flagstaff in 1980, and Rosie and I moved to Flagstaff with our young kids, and Bruce stayed up there, the towns were about equal size, kind of low 30s, 32,000, I think is what it was. And Casper never really broke out from that. They're probably 45, 50,000 now, but that's 40 years ago, 50 years ago. So no, they haven't gone through the huge growth. In fact, there's some little feed on news feed on the internet the other day. It was inexpensive towns to live in if you still want to ski. And they listed Casper, Wyoming, because you can still buy a house for a reasonable price in this funky little ski area. It's only half the size of Arizona Snow Bowl, but at least it's considered a ski area. So somehow that met some sort of criteria for the news article that if you want to ski cheap and live cheap, move to Casper, Wyoming.
No, that's cool, though. There's nothing like a small local mountain ski area.
And remind me, because that's something I got coming up maybe at the end we can talk about. I'm going to go to Vermont in 2 weeks to go ski nothing but small local mountains. It's going to be a gas.
Wow, that will be. I've always wanted to ski back east.
It's going to be really fun.
And so how did you work at, like, your brother and you decided to expand to some other place and just kind of worked it out as far as the company? You handed off the presidency to him?
Or not right away.
Or were you an extension of the same company?
We were the same company, and we were looking around. Things were going really well in Casper, and we were looking around other communities. We were looking at Fort Collins. We were looking at Ogden, Utah, Sheridan, Wyoming. An old friend we met and known in Casper had moved here to Flagstaff. And he said, you guys might want to check out Flagstaff, Arizona. And I'm embarrassed to say, back then I wasn't sure if Flagstaff was New Mexico or Arizona. I had no idea where it was. And we came down here and this old friend said, check it out. And the Arizona Snow Bowl, we got on going there right away. Same thing, we did a business study through a guy at the university and to check out the demographics, what's going on.
Certain components that you're kind of looking for.
Yep. And it made sense. And as that business study evolved, communication opened up that the Flagstaff Sportsman might be for sale. So we put that deal together in 1980 and had one company, Mountain Sports, with a Wyoming location and an Arizona location.
Yeah, I was always under that impression, yeah.
And we did that for, I think, another 10 years. Now we split the company. He's got Wyoming, and now Flagstaff, Arizona is owned and operated by my daughter, Lisa.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your Flagstaff shop. You were like your model was the full-blown, year-round sporting store. And then you've since transisted into a single label sort of software.
Branding, yeah. Yep.
The branding. And I really identify with that because I kind of did that without even knowing it with the vocal brand and stuff. But that's that location, how'd you arrive at that? McGaw's had moved out of there, the newsstand.
Yep,
and then was anything in there between McGaw's and you?
Nope. It's the evolution was we started, as you said, downtown at the underpass. And then for 20 years, we had the all outdoor sports store at Greentree Village Shopping Center.
Right.
Where people in Flagstaff know that location now as SMR, Snow Mountain River. It seems to be a business model that's working there now. And that was in 73, we were just a ski shop in Wyoming, and there was nothing else to do. But the ski sport was growing so fast, you could just be a ski shop and then sit around and scratch your head during the summer and wait for the next ski season. And then I guess we did tennis. So we were looking for other counter-seasonal sports. And when we got Flagstaff Sportsman here, that was all sports. That was ping pong paddles.
Oh, it was a beautiful story. Beautiful story.
And softball uniforms. But pretty quickly, we started refining the mix and getting down to backpacking, skiing. Snowboarding hadn't been invented yet. Mountain bikes were just starting. We jumped on that. And that seemed to work both year-round business.
Yeah, That was a beautiful store.
And then the big outdoor store on South Milton. We expanded. We had a store in Prescott, Arizona for 3 years. Then the snow started changing. The economics started changing. 9/11 happened. It put us in a tight spot with the big store financially. But also that whole time we've been looking for a little downtown location just to work with one of our brands, Patagonia Clothing, and kind of do nothing but Patagonia Clothing in the downtown. And we talked to several landlords up to that years before, trying to find the location. In fact, we were always looking at that McGaw's corner. And Lillian Ostoff, who had that business, liked it there, and she didn't want to move. And then she decided to retire. So as she retired it was right after 9/11. She retired, and that lease opened up, and we said, well, let's put a Patagonia store in downtown. We thought we'd still have the big store in South Milton with all the sports. Meg Vieira managed that downtown store for us. An old similar person that worked with you, too.
Mm-hmm.
And within 6 months, we knew we had to close the big store. So I had to reinvent my whole business and my whole world around the smaller store. Patagonia, and it actually turned out pretty well, as you know.
Yeah, it's a beautiful little store, and it seems like you really have a good movement and traffic. And
great location, good brand loyalty. There's a lot of folks who love Patagonia Clothing for its quality and its business ethics and environmental message, and they've been great partners for us in that location for 20 years.
And if you guys ever need Patagonia, it's right downtown there in the historic downtown Flagstaff. Beautiful location.
So through all that, coming to Flagstaff, that's kind of how I got interested in the ski race work as an official, because my kids were starting a ski race, and Bill Gaylord was my mentor. He was saying, hey, you know, if you're helping the kids, why don't you also help out by being a gate judge or help out?
Well, that was my next question, because you have really taken that pretty deep. So explain that to our listener as far as how that works. I remember even doing some timing with you, but you've had to go through quite a bit of certification and stuff to be an official.
Yep.
But I kind of explained that process, because I that was my next question for you. Actually.
This is because of kids, and I use the Little League model as a great model example. My kids were involved in ski racing, so you're a family up there all the time helping out. I wasn't coaching at that time, but the Flagstaff Ski Club, which is, I think, 50 years old now, and had a great tradition in Flagstaff and has wonderful kids that have come through this program. And and you're out there on the hill watching your kids go by and train and start ski racing. And so like a little league parent, you want to start helping out by being a coach or a umpire or something like that. And so it starts out that way, and you get trained. You start getting trained through local and regional training events, and you start off as a gatekeeper. Then you get involved in timing. Art Dalpez taught me timing, yeah. And you were helping out there. And I really enjoyed it. So as my kids are progressing through the different higher levels of ski racing, my ski race officials work was starting to advance by more training, more certifications, more out-of-town experience. And the family joke is the kids have been out of ski racing for 30 years, but I was still involved.
You never left.
I just kept building my credentials. And at the U.S. Nationals level, I was called a U.S. technical delegate. And what technical delegates are is they're kind of like the race director. They're responsible for everything on the hill with the event. So they have gatekeepers working for them, timers working for them, coaches working for them. They're representing the athletes. And you do that at the national level. And then I had the promotion and opportunity to do it at the international level.
Yeah, I followed that. That was exciting stuff, I'll bet.
It was. It's really cool. And it's something I did for 25 years. And it was a lot of hard work, but I traveled to amazing ski areas all over the North America and Europe and Asia, and was around some incredible athletes. And parallel to ski racing, it was just when snowboarding was becoming an Olympic sport. So I was one of the first certified snowboard technical delegates also.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
Parallel to that, as the snowboard events got going with half pipe and big air and the terrain parks, freestyle skiing jumped in. And there's FIS technical delegate. FIS is Fédération Internationale de Ski. They're the international governing body for all winter sports. So it's what feeds into the Olympics and world championships. And as the freestyle, so it was Oberhof in Switzerland is who I work for, is where FIS is based out of. And these international competitions, freestyle skiing started coming on stronger, and FIS took that over to become the Olympic representative. So at one point, I was one of three international technical delegates that could do freestyle, snowboard, and alpine. Most technical delegates would pick one, but because of my crossover experience, just being involved in the sport as an enthusiast,
cool is that?
So it was kind of a funny little niche, but it was wonderful.
Were you able to get in on the Olympics?
My Olympics was Vancouver.
Uh-huh.
That was the one.
I thought I remembered you had that opportunity.
I was the snowboard competition director for the snowboard and ski cross events and the snowboard parallel GS events. And then next door, this is all right outside of Cypress Mountain, right outside of downtown Vancouver. Vancouver's a beautiful city on the water, and North Vancouver is these huge mountains just blast right out of the water, and they got three great mountains right there. And then another hour up the road is Whistler, which is an amazing place too.
Yeah.
So that was a month in Vancouver of, we'd get up at 3 a.m. and go find the donut shop that would unlock the door for us at 4 a.m. and get up on the hill at 5 a.m. and come home at night at 10 a.m. and just crash.
Oh, yeah, I bet it was a hard driving time. And those were great Olympics, too. I mean, that's the North American
pride. The U.S. and Canada did well. We had a lot of pride with the snowboard involvement. It was that was one of the big Olympics for a guy named Sean White, who just retired a few days ago at the Winter Olympics in Beijing. He did his final
run. The Flying Tomato.
Yep.
Awesome.
He was legendary back then. And when we wouldn't have events, we'd get a day or two off. And Vancouver's beautiful, dynamic downtown city.
Oh, it really is. It's beautiful.
Fun. And all the Olympic houses were downtown Vancouver. So every country has its USA house or its Swiss house. And you get credentials that you can get into these different private functions with these cocktail parties and great food. And the USA house was celebrating and acknowledging, they have a tradition of every Olympics, they recognize a coach that is exemplary to the Olympic movement and quality and career and all the attributes, you know, that are wonderful. And the guy who was getting this recognition was a guy named Bud Keene, and he was Shaun White's private coach. And this is a little reception of about 30 people in the USA house. And Shaun introduced him, and, you know, Bud, and Bud was a very humble guy and accepting his award. And standing next to me in this small group of the USA houses is this guy that no one even knows who he is. He's Wayne Gretzky. he actually had carried the torch for the Vancouver Olympics. So he's hanging out with in the USA house because everyone knew him at the Canadian house. So
that's amazing.
And I'm talking to him with a couple of his handlers around him. And at that time, he was the coach and general manager of our Coyotes down in Phoenix, our NHL team.
Oh, that's right. That's right. He was involved with that franchise.
And it wasn't going well. I'm not a big hockey fan, but it wasn't going well. And it's kind of like Wayne, you know, I said, "Hey, Wayne, how about those Coyotes?" And he looked at me like, "Who are you? What are you talking to me in Canada about those Coyotes? All I've been doing is stinking that up." I said, "Well, I'm from Arizona." He said, "Oh, no, I understand."
You know, since we're on the subject of the great one,
yep.
Jen and I happened to be, we were working on a film thing in Toronto, mm-hmm. and he was there receiving his, well, two things happened. We went to this little thing because the guy we were staying with was a photographer for mm-hmm. the NHL.
Yeah.
But that he was being inducted into the Hall of Fame that day,
sure,
and so we saw the, you know, the trophy, we saw the great one,
yeah.
Hall of Fame, the whole deal, and we just, of course, had no idea until we got there.
Other than Wayne Gretzky in Arizona,
yeah, same thing.
Didn't go well.
he might be one of our medicine heroes. You and Matt might share that.
Yes,
but. That's really cool. But what a great experience. Are you still involved?
5 years ago, I turned 65, and they turn me out. They want you to turn in your license and turn it over to the next generation, the younger
people. They send you out across that field headed west.
Which is okay.
Towards the sunset.
It was fine because it was...
It's a mean world, though.
It was a lot of fun and a lot of unique experiences.
And probably a lot of work.
It is, but if you enjoy your work, it's okay.
That's right.
Japan was really cool. I was there a couple of times.
Oh, cool. And, I've always wanted to go to Japan.
Oh, it's just such a beautiful, friendly country, and they always get snow. It's called Japao, is what it's called.
Japao, yeah.
For powder snow.
Did you ski some of those mountains in the powder?
Yes. From Tokyo, my first time over there, you take a high-speed train over to the western side of the island to Nagano, where the 98 Winter Olympics were.
Yeah.
And no one realized that there's 500 ski areas in Japan. Most of them are little, but they have big, big resorts too. That this place, Nozawa Onsen was the name of it. I was there for about 2 weeks for their national championships, and it just snowed all the time on this race. It was a ski race. It was their national championships. And was held on the Kandahar course. And you go, Kandahar, isn't that European? And they go, yeah, it is. And this little community of Nozawa Onsen looks like an Austrian village. And it's because of this guy, Hans Schneider, who came over in the 60s from Austria, kind of like Stein Erikson came to our country. Well, Hans Schneider made his claim in Japan. And everything over there is named after Schneider, Hans Schneider Cup, and these little pensions, hotels.
It has the little alpine look.
Mm-hmm. Except as you have these little alpine European feeling chateaus, and right next to it is a little Buddhist temple. It's so cool. It's just so cool.
Yeah, a melt of cultural.
And then Onsen is the Japanese Mandarin for hot baths, hot springs. And just all these little hot springs, public and private, all over the community, in the hotel, along the city streets, and
they have that geothermal element on that.
The tectonic plates are shifting over there. Lots of big.
You could even take hot tubs with monkeys and stuff.
Well,
did you do that?
The snow monkeys, they're considered sacred over there, and they're in charge. And yes, they were in the hot, they weren't in the hot tub with you, in the hot spring with you. They'd sit on the edge of the hot spring and yell at you and squawk. And they're pretty big. They're 3 feet tall. And you know, we have to all get along.
And they're super strong.
Yeah. The little pension I was in, Nozawa, no, it was at Sugarcogan, the next place. But I was doing some afternoon work, and I had my door open to the balcony because it was pretty nice weather. And I look up, and there's a monkey in my room taking an apple off my counter and going, you know, I yelled at him, and he says, well, what's the big deal? And I threw my shoe at him. He said, still, what's the big deal?
And just, he was right at home being in your home.
Yep, scared the hell out of me.
Well, what great experiences the racing's brought then.
Yes, and back then, it's changed now. You mentioned powder. All the snow coming down, they're very kind of strict rules, unofficial rules there back then, that they'd groom the runs for you, and then right next would be beautiful tree skiing, and I'm looking at these beautiful new snow in the trees, and I'm trying to ask my host through my translator, you know, can the tracks, fresh tracks over there on the side of the hill? No, Mr. Mark, no, we don't ski over there. And I said, you mean you don't want to, or you cannot ski? Oh, we don't want to ski over there. I said, well, can I ski over there? Of course, Mr. Mark, you can go over there. And they have very unusual beech trees. They're kind of like aspens, but they're beautifully spaced, evenly spaced. And I was over there putting down first tracks on these.
Every run, huh? Because nobody skied it.
No. And they said, good for you, Mr. Mark, but we don't do that. And that's all changed now. Now they run powder tours everywhere.
Yeah. I still plan on getting over there and skiing sometime. Was it expensive?
Well, at the job I did, all my expenses are paid for, so I didn't even know.
Yeah.
They put you in fancy hotels and take care of everything.
And would you travel with your skis, or would you?
Sometimes, yes, but usually if I'm going to Europe or in North America, I'd bring my skis and snowboard, but going to Asia or Europe, I just bring my boots.
Boots, yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot easier.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
But there was the Japanese Alps, the Hakuba, they're just gorgeous, and they've been getting snow this year every day for the last 45 days, I've noticed on the weather maps. It's just crazy world.
Yeah.
All connected by high-speed train.
So the public transportation's second to none, I've heard.
Beautiful. Well done. And you get
bullet trains and
500 little ski areas and then the big ones. I mean, little ski areas like Snow Bowl. And then the Nozawa Onsen was a place that had 40 chairlifts.
Whoa.
And then our next stop was Sugarcogan for 2 weeks, and they had 70 chairlifts, but all these different aspects of the mountain. So you had these little pods that we worked out of for our races that had the hotels and pensions right there at the bottom of the pod, and then you kind of go up a ridge to another pod. And I'm trying to scratch my head to figure out 70 chairlifts scattered all over. And I asked my translator host, how many people come here on a weekend? And he said, 250,000. And I said, I had to write it down and show him. I said, make sure we're speaking the right number of zeros. He said, yes, Mr. Mark, 250,000 skiers can show up at this one place on a weekend from the bullet trains.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
But they're scattered all over these.
You don't really
lifts.
Feel the impact of them all because
nope.
They've got it.
Nope.
Sounds smart. And a lot of multifaceted mountains. And how high are the mountains in Japan?
Well, they're coming right off the water, kind of like the Vancouver mountains.
Yeah, right.
So they're, I think the top of their mountains is 3,000-4,000 feet above sea level, but just catching all this snow coming off
moisture,
Asia.
Huh?
Big, big, big.
And, you know, I want to touch on a subject that all of us kind of are either hearing about going through or going to go through it or have gone through it, but I want to talk to you about your transplanted hip. I know that's probably a subject you didn't expect to come up.
Let's not act old, but yes, let's talk about hips.
Tell us about the process. What were you just in too much pain? Or us through what it's like to get a replaced hip.
All
if you don't mind.
Yep. Oh, not at all. There's no HIPAA in this town. Everyone knows my story. My bones started falling apart. My joints started falling apart about 15 years ago. And what it turned out was I have real dense bones, and they're basically just grinding out all the surfaces at the joints. And it started with hips that I replaced and a knee that I replaced and spine surgery. And our wonderful surgeons in Flagstaff have done an incredible job keeping me glued together. And I'm skiing again.
Yeah, I love it.
And I'm very proud of that. But through all that, I always had quick recoveries. But then about 5-6 years ago, I hadn't had any surgeries for a while. All my joints had been replaced, basically. But what you're referring to is I somehow started getting an infection in one of my metal joints. And infection's a real weird deal in our body because our immune system's always fighting off infection every day. We don't even realize it. And what can happen with synthetic or metal in your body, like plastic heart valves or metal joints, is the bacteria can connect itself to the non-porous metal or the non-porous plastic. And the way our immune system works is you can't penetrate that material to eradicate the bacteria. So this bacteria can actually just start festering. And it was wreaking havoc. We couldn't figure out what was going on with my... I just felt dull and high blood pressure and dizzy and no energy, and, and we knew something was going on. It took a long time to figure out it was coming out from one of my joints. So to do a joint replacement, it's called a revision. So they take out your metal joints, and for a year, I didn't have any hips. They took my hips out.
Bilateral,
because they were both infected, and they put in this plastic spacer. So I was living a life in a wheelchair, and it's truly non-weight bearing, so that to get from my wheelchair to a seat or my wheelchair to a bed, I couldn't stand up. I'd have to slide across on a slide board. So it was pretty big deal.
Yeah, big deal. And now, did those plastic spacers have antibiotic?
Yeah, and plus infusions. I was on an infusion pump for 6 months. I mean, just everything that I had to do to try and get this bacteria flushed.
Well, we were all worried about you. I mean, that's a long haul right there, brother.
And I appreciate the worry. And I guess I had gotten into my own realm of figuring this out and figuring out how I was going to conquer this and get better. But fortunately, now that I did and look back on it, some of you look at me like you're seeing a ghost. You're saying, whoa, you pulled that off. We had written you off, Lamberson. We figured you were down for the count.
I never wrote you off.
Brian, thank you.
Well, that's a wild one, because what a long haul, and what that does to your psychology and all that.
It can beat you up.
I salute you for coming through it in such fine fashion.
Well, and it's because of that goofy sport of skiing that I had the motivation to still want to be involved. It's been part of my life.
We've still got time to go, after this interview, we've got time to go skiing with each other sometime here soon.
Hopefully soon. Not today, maybe, but got to shovel first.
And so you're basically retired from the business, or do you still work for your daughter and do some stuff? Or what's our current Mark Lamberson story?
My daughter, Lisa Lamberson, owns Mountain Sports for the last 6 years and is doing a wonderful job.
And oh, by the way, she's a fantastic gal, and it's really cool to see that transition, that family affair.
It worked out. Never know.
It's a neat thing to see.
Our daughter and son, Lisa and then Brett, they came out of Flagstaff Public Schools and went to universities and lived all over North America. And for their own reasons, they both circled back to Flagstaff, which is neat because my wife Rosie and I love Flagstaff, but you don't know if their kids are going to be here or not. You just got to let them go.
No, it's great to have them back. I mean, Brett's done full circle, and now he's got a baby.
So Lisa's runs the company. It's her company, and she keeps me around as a part-time bookkeeper and a soothsayer.
So you've still got your fingers on the pulse a little bit of helping out.
I help out. And I am by no means in charge. I have to listen to my boss, and she hadn't fired me yet.
And I'm sure she's doing a great job of being a boss. She's very kind. Wonderful girl.
She has wonderful people skills. She knows how to build a good team around her. And
she is a tremendous skier, too.
She still likes to put it down the mountain.
Wow, she sure does. And both your kids are just phenomenal skiers. Now, in regards to what you're seeing happen here in Flagstaff, I think we already touched on that it's blowing up.
Mm-hmm.
But aren't you impressed with what they've done to try and keep up with the demand up at the Snowball? It's a really nice ski area. Coleman came in and really did some smart things. But on a year like this, with the lack of snow up to now that we've had, the quality of that product of skiing that they provide and the amount of skiable surface, it compares with those really bleak snow years we had to where they were open maybe a couple weeks in the whole season. And I just look back on those days that we survived through, but, you know, I was putting my river paychecks into the bills and stuff. Pretty phenomenal change of events.
Yeah, we're very fortunate to have the partnership that manages and runs that ski area now, because Mountain Capital Partners has the financial resources. We have one of the best experts in ski area management in the country who's always lived here, J.R. Murray.
Yep.
And my goodness, that combination has really opened up great things for the community, for the state, for the town, for the economy. And
it's been something.
And we know what it's been like in the not so good years. It's pretty dramatic.
Yeah, if you're a skier, but you know the element of water in the West, and what we're watching our Colorado River Basin going through, it's not just the snow.
No,
it's a whole change in this climate.
And how unique that we're one of two or three skiers in North America that uses the reclaimed water, and even though that's got its pluses and minuses in the community, it's really the intelligent way to use a resource that we have. That $80 million reclaimed water facility that the city of Flagstaff citizens voted for 30 years ago, and all that reclaimed water goes on our city parks, soccer fields, golf courses all summer long, but the water's still reclaimed all winter long and no use for it. So for J.R. Murray and the Snowball to come up with a contract and agreement to use that winter water that's reclaimed to make their snow is a unique and smart idea.
Yeah, and it refuses to the environment. I mean, it's it's
recharges
and re-cleanses a lot of a lot of people's controversial idea about it, but
it's controversial and it's unfortunate, but we want to all work together and respect everyone's thoughts and beliefs.
And never forget, water is yesterday's oil, today's water. It's an amazing thing that we need.
Mm-hmm.
But we're kind of running out of time for this one. Would you like to add anything? Do you want to tell the people something smart? Environmentally smart for us. What do you got?
Oh, environmentally smart, just that we gotta keep looking at the long haul. I'm an optimist. I'm a guy that says the glass is half full, not half empty. Sometimes it's a challenge, but the environment's gonna continue to struggle for us, and we have to be smart. All these little steps we do now hopefully can have some benefit and to at least start changing the path of this battleship going chugging along. And unfortunately, even though we might be holistic and want to do it for the environment, which we have to do, it's going to come down to the economics. And the economics, in my opinion, is going to finally drive us more and more to the environmental solution, because the other way economically won't make sense anymore. And we're seeing that with wind production, energy production, solar and wind power. And that's where my faith is that smart people, much smarter than you and I, are going to keep figuring this out. And also, I see a lot of animated young people in their 20s, which I just love, because I grew up in the 60s and University of Colorado and the Vietnam War and Earth First, and we were fired up back then. And I see these young people fired up again, and it's really neat to see. I've got a lot of faith in them.
No, that is optimistic. And, you know, the economic driving force of everything, I really hope that you're right, because there is a certain self-cleansing this planet has. Mm-hmm. You know, they even saw that in the parks and when everybody was locked away during the COVID crisis. You know, the birds came out and things cleaned up. I think that economic element is a smart way to look at it. But isn't it wonderful compared to us in our 20s, just the grand amount of information and resource these guys have to make choices.
Yes.
And to pick their fights.
Yes.
It's really exciting to watch them grow and take ownership.
And with that ownership, I think there is going to be more challenges coming that the young people, I'm counting on them to save our butts, because we need help, and there's a lot of young energy out there.
And in so many ways, we haven't done them any favors.
You're right.
The solution is all in their hands eventually. So,
anything I can do to support them.
Yeah, no, those are great closing words. And I'll tell you what, I really enjoy sitting down with you like this. We've known each other for a long time, but there's something kind of wonderful about sitting one-on-one in a room and finding out about each other. Right?
It's a pleasure to go over that skiing heritage. And
yeah, we've got a lot.
You've had and I've had. And
got a lot of pride in all that.
And I salute you. You're still doing it.
Well, some of us are smarter than others, and I salute you for being so smart. Well, you know, this is Big Adventures with Mark Lamberson and Brian Dericker. And you guys, thanks for sitting in and listening. Very interesting story. All of us should really enjoy going skiing with Mark, because he's a beautiful skier, and he's back on him after all he's the bionic skier.
Yep.
And, you know, stay right side up, you guys out there, and get your COVID shots or your boosters, still potentially out there. And, hey, love the fact that you're sitting there listening to me. Big Adventures, signing out.
Big Adventures is produced by Brian Dericker, Margaret Knight, and me, Gavin Bugner. Bill Gleckler and his mandolin provide our music. If you like our show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.